Welcome back to the show, everybody. The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. We've got a gigantic show for you. We're going to be starting off with a new report showing just how many of the both threats of violence and also violent acts have been tied to Donald Trump. Not by liberal pundits online, but by the people who have actually perpetrated these attacks. We'll be breaking down a number of these, and there are dozens. We're not going to go through all, obviously, but there's so much else we're going to get to, too. Big interview coming up that will be released in full tomorrow. Hopefully, we'll have footage tomorrow for you as well. But Bernie Sanders sitting down with Cardi B to talk about a number of different policies. We've got a small preview of it that we're going to be closing out the show with today. But the bulk of the show is going to be consumed both by a couple of awesome guests, including the return to the show of Ken Klippenstein, who got documents leaked from the FBI showing what the priorities are of the FBI when it comes to different terrorist groups and different classifications of terrorist groups. But then also we're going to be returning to what is becoming sort of a mini arc for the week of animals, climate change, biodiversity. When I put it that way, I know that it's not incredibly exciting or sexy, but it is important. And so we're going to be talking about elephants, we're going to be talking about tamarins and climate change. What effect do animals have on the climate of the planet? And I have a feeling it's going to be a little bit surprising. So lots to get to. Why don't we jump right into it? Starting off, of course, with Donald Trump, violence and rhetoric. At this point, I think most people understand that there's a very clear link, a very clear bold line between the things that Donald Trump and other right-wing politicians and right-wing pundits say and some of the violence that we've seen, both individual acts of violence and intimidation threats and things like that, but also terror attacks like in El Paso. Now, there is one person who still does not like that connection, doesn't buy that connection. That would be Donald Trump, who said, "I think my rhetoric brings people together." That was just about a week ago. He also last year said he deserves no blame for what he called the hatred seemingly coursing through parts of the country. And he told reporters that he's committed to doing everything in his power to not let political violence take root in America. Well, of course he can say that and he's gonna say that, but it turns out that there's actually literally dozens of instances of violence with a documented connection to Donald Trump by the people who perpetrated those attacks. We're gonna turn to those in just a minute, but I want to let Donald Trump make the case against Donald Trump not being responsible. Here's a little mashup J.R. Jackson put together of some of the instances where he seems to kind of be okay with violence.
Bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. You know what they are? They're thugs. Yeah, build that wall. You're right. I think there's blame on both sides. I think there's blame on both sides. You know what? We're not letting these people invade our country. If you look at the border and you look at the hundreds of thousands of people that are invading, or at least trying to invade our country. It is an invasion, you know that. I say invasion, they say, isn't that terrible?
I don't care what the fake media says, that's an invasion of our country.
But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement.
I can't see how that's not on the news literally every single day. Him laughing as one of his supporters says, just shoot the immigrants, that'll solve the problem. And so you see there him echoing the sorts of, normally to get that sort of rhetoric, you have to read an actual terrorist manifesto, but now we get it on cable news and Twitter literally every day. And so here's the thing, he can say whatever he wants about whatever liability he people are saying he has, but we know what the actual people perpetrating acts of violence and terror are saying. So a nationwide review conducted by ABC News has identified at least 36 criminal cases where Trump was invoked in direct connection with violent attacks, threats of violence or allegations of assault. The 36 cases are remarkable in that a link to the president is captured in court documents and police statements under the penalty of perjury or contempt. And so let's be very clear about what we're talking about here. We're not talking about 36 cases where someone is looking at it and says, that seems like it's connected with the president. This is 36 cases where under threat of additional jail time, the individuals involved in the cases say this has to do with Donald Trump. Now, not all of them are against Trump. There are actually 9 of the 36 that are perpetrated in defiance of Trump, it says. But the vast, vast majority are Trump supporters or people who like Trump's message that are saying that is why they did what they did. Now, let's break down what form this actually comes in. In 9 cases, perpetrators hailed Trump in the midst or immediate aftermath of physically attacking innocent victims. They are literally shouting his name as they're attacking people. In another 10 cases, perpetrators cheered or defended Trump while taunting or threatening others. So there, it didn't quite go to the extent of violence, but it got right up to the edge. In another 10 cases, Trump and his rhetoric were cited in court to explain a defendant's violent or threatening behavior. So they didn't shout his name literally while they were perpetrating the act, but their legal defense was grounded on, I just love Donald Trump and I was doing what he told me to do. And what sort of people are these? You're gonna be shocked to find out. They look like you might imagine a Trump supporter would. The perpetrators and suspects identified in the 36 cases are mostly white men, as young as teenagers and as old as 75, while the victims largely represent an array of minority groups, African Americans, Latinos, Muslims, and gay men. And so here's the thing, we can have, you know, commentators, pundits, analysts, whatever, we can have arguments back and forth and we can try to convince rational people in the middle as to the danger of invoking certain tropes, pushing certain narratives that terrorists obviously are big fans of. I will continue to try to do that. I personally think that if it would be indistinct, if my show would be the same if a terrorist was my producer, then there's probably something wrong with my show. That's what I would say. If I think that my show goes out there and people who are right on the cusp of committing terror attacks are cheering for me while I'm doing the show, that's probably a problem as well. Now, there are people on cable news that don't seem to be bothered by that and they'll continue. We put out a challenge to Tommy Lauren in particular because she likes to say that she's reasonable and she's not dogmatic like other Republicans, but she has said that she's going to continue to use the language of invasion, militarizing and dehumanizing language of that sort. So they've found a way to get past it, but it is serious. And I wanna give you an idea of how serious it is by just going through a few of the cases. Now, obviously we can't go through all 36. It's literally page after page of individual attacks, but I just was reading a few and I highlighted a few and I wanna let you know how this actually looks in practice. So back in August 2015 in Boston, there was a man, Stephen Leader. He beat a sleeping homeless man of Mexican descent with a metal pole. He later told police, Donald Trump was right, all these illegals need to be deported. So that wasn't something that he allegedly said during the attack. That wasn't something that we could sort of read into his clothing that he thinks. He had just been arrested for assaulting a person, potentially trying to kill that person, and he offered up, Donald Trump was right, we need to get these illegals out of here. Not long after that, in December of 2015, there was a Penn State student who was charged with ethnic intimidation for threatening to put a bullet, in his words, in a young Indian man on campus. His attorneys said, well, look, it was just motivated by a love of country, not hate. He wanted to put a bullet in a fellow student because of a love of country. I guess love comes in many forms. And he was quoted as saying, Donald Trump is running for president of the United States, saying that we've got to check people out more closely. Which is something that Donald Trump said many times. And what do you know? One of his followers at college thought, I might have to shoot another student because we gotta check these people out more closely. Let's see, in June of 2016, there's a 54-year-old Henley Slapnick who attacked his African American neighbors with a knife in Cleveland. He told police, quote, Donald Trump will fix them because they are scared of Donald Trump. That is in police reports there. He ultimately pleaded guilty to ethnic intimidation and other charges, although we have no idea at this point what his sentence actually was. Let's see, in August of 2016, we have a 32-year-old Daniel Rowe attacked a white woman and a black man with a knife after seeing them kiss. He professed to being a white supremacist and said, quote, he planned on heading down to the next Donald Trump rally and stomping out more of the Black Lives Matter group. And look, it wasn't involved in that mashup that we showed you, but Donald Trump and right wingers in the media have demonized Black Lives Matter since, honestly, before it actually had a name that could be identified. And what do you know? Some people wanna go and they wanna attack those people. And then, and this one really stood out to me, like there's a million I could read, but at one point in Bordentown, New Jersey, the chief of their police department assaulted an African-American teenager who was handcuffed. While he was being held, I should say, he was secretly recorded saying, Donald Trump is the last hope for white people. That's the chief of a police department who has a person in handcuffs and beats them because he's been given hope by Donald Trump. Now, if at this point, after all of these years, after all of these attacks, terror attacks, both that went through, those who were thwarted, if you don't see the connection, you're never going to because you don't want to. You don't live in the reality-based world. That's just the way it is. But for people who are reasonable, people who are worried about violence, who are worried about racism, This is just yet more proof of what we've been saying for literally years now. This is dangerous. The people spreading this message know how dangerous it is, and they choose to do it anyway. And so when there are more attacks, the blood will continue to be on their hands. Okay, we're gonna take a break here. When we come back, Ken Klippenstein is gonna be joining us to talk about political extremism and how the FBI is approaching it after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The FBI has an obligation to protect us from acts of terror. That is their duty. They're supposed to be investigating the true threats that we face, and they deserve a lot of credit a lot of the time. We notice frequently attacks that have been foiled. We notice here that those attacks get much less media coverage than the ones that go through, which is sort of a perverse system we've set up. But they do a good job for the most part. And unfortunately, that is undercut at times, either by directives from the top, such as telling the FBI to focus on one type of terror rather than another, defunding certain programs, but also bias inside of the organization. And so I want to talk about an aspect of that. What sorts of terror groups are the FBI focusing on internally? Joining us now to break this down, investigator for TYT Investigates, Ken Klippenstein. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, Ken. So you were able to get some leaked documents that reveal that some of the public statements of the FBI about their priorities, which sorts of groups that they're looking into, they haven't been fully honest about that, right?
That's right. What I found from the leaked documents was that while they were telling Senate Democrats that they had gotten rid of this very controversial term, quote, black identity extremists, which the documents show were directly tied to the protests in Ferguson following the death of Michael Brown, a highly politicized term. They told Senate Democrats that they stopped using that term, but it looks like they just put it that term along with the constituent definition under a new term that sounds more innocuous, but they basically kept most of the same things.
And so they're still, they're still looking into it. They still obviously prioritize it. They changed the name basically, like a company rebranding after a scandal. One quick note I wanna get to is you talked about how they classify in order of ranking the importance of these different groups. So they had black identity extremists, now they have the racially motivated extremism. How does that rank on their priority scale of how big of a threat it is?
Well, what I thought was incredible about it was that by fiscal year 2020, which is the most recent of the documents that I got, and these are the official priorities, counterterror priorities for the FBI going forward. And so it lists their foremost concerns that they're gonna, invest resources and manpower into trying to deter. And what the documents show is that as of 2020, they actually prioritize the group that contains black identity extremists above terror affiliates like Al-Qaeda. And it's and you know, other offshoots from foreign Islamist terror groups like that. So I find that pretty shocking.
I think most people will probably find that pretty shocking, and that's not something that they wanted to be very explicit about. Obviously, it sort of tied in with this. I mean, we're focusing on the legacy of their focus on so-called black identity extremists and how highly they've prioritized them. But we know that when it comes to domestic terror attacks, if there is racially motivated terror, it is not coming from black identity extremists. Was there anything in your documents that show that the FBI might be taking white supremacist terror more seriously than Trump and other sort of vocal aspects of the federal government have implied that they will?
Well, unfortunately, it looks like they actually conflate black identity extremists, so-called, with white supremacists by putting it in the exact same category as them. And, you know, that to me is wild, not just in light of the, you know, spate of recent, you know, apparent white supremacist attacks, but also for the simple fact that in the documents themselves, they, you know, don't cite any specific examples of fatalities that resulted from these so-called black extremists, whereas they cite, you know, a bunch of different attacks from the white supremacist groups, which makes sense because there are just a whole lot more of them. So I find that, you know, attempt to conflate these two groups to be pretty astonishing.
Although not unprecedented, because when Donald Trump talks about extremism, even when he talked about extremism in the immediate aftermath of the El Paso terror attacks, he says that any supremacy is bad, implying that there are other supremacies other than white supremacy, but that they're just as violent. And so I guess that this gets into the area of speculation. We can't say for sure, but if they can't cite specific instances like they can with things like white supremacy, is it possible that this is the result of political pressure to appease people who want to pretend that this is a both sides sort of thing? Like, do we have any idea to go on in that area?
Yeah, so I can go off of what my sources are telling me within the FBI, and that is that there was an internal conflict and quite a bit of deliberation over, you know, how they were going to pursue this. So that's certainly a concern on the part of at least the folks I'm talking to within the Bureau. And I can't imagine that, you know, this concern is arising out of nothing.
I want to talk about sort of the meta context around this story, because you did great work in finding these documents and rebutting the official line from the FBI, which is no small feat. In terms of pickup, this could not have come out at a more opportune time, tragically, because of the attacks that have happened recently. Has there been a lot of pickup of your work in larger media sources?
Hardly any, which was surprising to me, because we had, you know, very high profile, you know, groups pushing for the release of exactly these documents. And I'm seeing the Chiron right now, Operation Iron Fist. That was actually the name, the code name that the FBI gave, you know, this counterintelligence strategy that they were using against the so-called black identity extremists. So I thought, you know, the term itself, the fact that these various nonprofit groups were litigating to try to release these documents and just getting struck down left and right by the federal government, you know, including the ACLU, something, you know, folks might have heard of. I thought that with all of this very high profile attention that, you know, this is going to, you know, set off, I had hoped, you know, for, further inquiry from the bigger papers with more resources to root out more specifics. And unfortunately, that hasn't been the case.
And so I would recommend to our viewers, people who are watching or listening to this right now, this is opportune not just because it links up with massive news stories, but also because we need reform in this area. We need the FBI to have the right priorities. It's clear that that pressure to reform is never going to come from inside of the Trump administration. So what we need is a high profile politician to start a national conversation about reforming the FBI, making them focus more on domestic terror from right wing groups, from white supremacist groups. And so Ken's work, either the story that's available on 2AT.com or, you know, this or any of the other interviews that Ken is doing, please send these to progressive politicians to hopefully get them to put pressure on the FBI. Ken, as always, your work is amazing. Thank you for doing what you do and joining us on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, man.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, more on animals and climate change. The two are connected, but not necessarily always in the direction you'd think.
This bird is seriously dangerous, but beautiful.
So that is Donald Trump doing, I think, a Time magazine cover shoot a couple years ago. And this week we're investigating a couple of things. One is why Donald Trump hates animals as much as he does. And that is a little bit of evidence to put in the case file for that. But we're also investigating animals and biodiversity, nature, climate change more broadly, and looking at the connection between all of them. Because right there, Donald Trump, even Donald Trump, one of the least curious humans to ever walk the face of the earth, acknowledges that it's an important animal in some respect. He doesn't understand anything beyond that, but he gets that it's important. And the thing is, for people who actually study animals of different species, they understand that they're not just scary or just beautiful. They're important in a lot of ways, some of which we don't see on a day-to-day basis. And so I want to talk about some of the research on two different species and how important they are in respect to climate change, and perhaps helping to mitigate some of the worst effects of climate breakdown. This topic might seem a little bit crazy, like what does an animal have to do? What is my dog gonna do about climate change? But it turns out that some species actually are pretty important, because the way that our biosphere is set up, the way that species interact, it's like dominoes. Some dominoes don't actually support each other, but some can support each other, others can knock each other down. If one is knocked down, others might follow, and we have some instances of that here. I wanna start off with elephants. So in Central Africa, elephants eat fast-growing trees, making room for those that grow more slowly. The slow-growing trees, with their very dense wood, store more carbon than their thinner, faster-developing counterparts. By killing elephants, poachers rob slow-growing trees of their guardian. They also slow the growth of new trees. Elephants blaze trails and disperse seeds as they forage. Without elephants, more carbon would accumulate in the atmosphere, worsening climate change. And so, that I had never known that before, literally yesterday when I was doing research for this story. But the way that they graze is important, both in developing the sorts of trees that we need far more of to help capture carbon that's already out there in the atmosphere, but also to develop new forests where forests don't currently live. That's gonna be a trend that we'll see in a lot of animals. And so as elephants have been killed over the last half century or so, we have been damaging our ability in an important region of the world to build the sorts of trees we need to help take some of the carbon out of the atmosphere. And indeed, the process we just described, it's been happening. A lot of elephants have been killed. Let's bring up this chart and you'll see the overall numbers descending rapidly. If we go back about a century, you had close to 10 million elephants at one point, and you see them just rocketing down to where now we have 300, and I think that's 52,000. And this is with some limited efforts to maintain these species. And that's the connection, really, to the Endangered Species Act story that we did earlier this week, where sure, there are not elephants wandering across the Great Plains of Kansas, but our commitment to protecting the animals we have here is important for fostering an international community that respects these animal species and will prioritize protecting them. Elephants are important. There are species here in the US that are important as well. And the thing is, like, we have everything that we need. We have all the knowledge, all the technology to track and protect these animals, but we don't put the resources into it. We put it elsewhere. And one researcher who does work on elephants says, we will go to Mars, there's no doubt, humans are too smart not to, yet we do not have the wisdom to protect elephants and their forest environment that do so much for our physical, spiritual, and emotional well-being. And the thing is, like, we should do it purely for the elephants, for the animals, for respect for a species that is quite intelligent and emotional and social and all of that. But we could also just do it pragmatically, because having a couple million more elephants would help us in developing the sorts of forests that we need to help mitigate some of the worst effects of the climate crisis. Now, we're gonna talk more about deforestation and reforestation tomorrow, but I wanna talk about one more species right now. So we go from the gigantic elephants down to the tiny little tamarin, which we're gonna show you some pictures of. They live in Peruvian rainforests and they eat fruit from trees. Then they poop out the undigested seeds in degraded former pastures, areas where there has been deforestation. This is land cleared by humans for grazing water buffalo, for agriculture and things like that. But when the tiny tamarins poop out those undigested seeds, they're effectively reseeding these areas and helping to develop future forests. And so tiny little tamarin, these are animals that are not themselves threatened or endangered, at least at this point. Although if deforestation continues the way it is now, at some point they could be. And I mean, just look at that picture. This is like the most adorable animal you could possibly imagine. But those tiny little animals just going about their lives, eating and pooping the way that they do, they are helping us to do what we need to do when it comes to forests. And there is a lot of work ahead of us, but there's a lot of benefit if we actually make good on it. In a new study, researchers found that the planet has nearly 3.5 million square miles to spare for trees. Such newly planted trees, if we were to grow them, could cut carbon in the atmosphere by nearly 25%, bringing it down to levels not seen for nearly 100 years. Now, at the end of the day, if we are going to take up this challenge of planting as many trees as possible to help cut into the carbon, you know, the oversaturation that we have in the atmosphere now, that's gonna be on humans. It's gonna be on human ingenuity and effort and technology as well. But we are shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't protect the animals that are helping to make this a little bit easier of a process. You know, if you're not convinced by their natural beauty or the wanting to maintain these species for future generations, or just, you know, a belief that species belong on the planet, that we should not interfere with their continuation, do it pragmatically. Do it because it can make it a little bit easier to avoid some of the worst effects of climate change. And unfortunately, here in the US, we have a government that is making the wrong moves in literally all of these areas, allowing corporations to wipe out vital animal species, caring nothing about maintaining forests and things like that. They've opened up national parks to resource development in the areas of energy extraction and mining, destroying not only the natural resources like trees and things like that, but also destroying sacred sites of Native Americans as they're doing it. And in terms of international leadership, I mean, is Donald Trump and his cronies, are they the people that you want interacting with the UN, helping to make sure that poaching is cut back in some of these areas, helping to make sure that elephants aren't eventually just sort of a memory we have of some big animal? There's not much time in these areas. We don't have time to be dilly-dallying either when it comes to species or trees or climate. We need to go full force in all of these areas, and that's why a change of leadership is so desperately needed. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, guest's gonna be joining us in person to relay a really sad but personal view on some of the recent terror attacks after this.
Animals are innocent.
In the wake of about a week ago, the terror attacks in El Paso and Dayton, I was left in much the same way that I always am when there are attacks like this. I try to put myself in the place of the people who are affected, the survivors of the attacks, their family and friends, and it is unimaginable. No matter how many times we have attacks like this, I honestly cannot imagine what it's like to be in that situation, to have lost someone that I love in one of these horrendous attacks. But there are people every time who have to deal with that. The survivors have to deal with what happened. And we're joined in studio now by someone who lost someone in the Dayton terror attacks. We're gonna talk about that experience. Jevin Lamar, you lost your cousin.
Yes,
in Dayton that day.
Yes, I did. I lost.
Thank you for joining us, by the way. I know this has got to be very difficult to talk about.
Yes.
But tell us about your experience.
Well, on that, actually, I was out of the country. My mentor, Greg Palace, he had just got married, and I was the ring bearer.
Oh wow!
So, in that happening, I was turning 25 to August 4th. That's the day that the shooting happened. Mm-hmm. So the happiest time of my life became the worst time of my life because mm-hmm. it was just like, I was already upset about it was that the mass shooting, right? But I didn't know it was my cousin.
Yeah.
And I was tweeting, saying we need change. We need to change as people. We have to change, But when I found out it was my cousin that mm-hmm. morning of my birthday, it was tragic. Like I was sick. I was like destroyed. My family is like, they're broken from this because mm-hmm. it was so random. Like TJ, that's my cousin's name. His name is Thomas Nicholas. TJ, he had to work. He had to work in the morning, you know? Mm-hmm. He got kids. He has kids that he's not going to get to see. He has kids that he's not going to get to see walk across the stage to graduate. He's not going to be able to see what his kids' dreams are.
Yeah.
His kids are all under 66. He has two girls and two boys. And it's just like hard to think about the way he was taken out.
And that they've lost him.
And they lost him.
At such a young age.
Yes. It's crazy.
So, and you have a strong connection to the area, obviously, in terms of family. Yes. You've done work. You mentioned Greg. You've done work for him in the Dayton area.
So you have
the personal connection to your cousin, but also this place that you have very different memories of. I mean, when you think about that area now, how has that been colored by the recent attacks?
Well, we're just getting over a massive tornado that hit Dayton. Mm-hmm. It hit Dayton. It took a lot of stuff. Like, so that brought the city together. It seemed it brought the city together. There's still people like struggling and dealing with the tornado.
Yeah.
And then this massive shooting happens in the safest place to go. Have fun. Dayton is pretty dangerous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Certain areas you can't go. Like when you go to like a club or a party, there might be shootings there.
Mm-hmm.
It might be, but that place, the Oregon District, is one of the safest places to go.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's crazy that doesn't happen there. Massive attacks, shooting, terrorism, it doesn't happen in Dayton. That's just unknown. It's like shocking that happened.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that sadly, that's a story that we've heard about a number of different areas. Areas like the churches in different parts of the country, they're supposed to be the safest place. The last thing on your mind is that something like this could happen.
Yes.
And then suddenly your memories are of that area are always going to be changed. You mentioned just a minute ago that you after you heard about it, you were tweeting about how there needs to be change. You actually ended up getting banned from social media platforms as a result of that.
I got banned off of Twitter. Mm-hmm. I was hashtagging. These hashtags were trending. Trump's terrorist. White supremacist terrorists in my hometown Dayton were trending at number one.
Mm-hmm.
So I had tweeted an image. It was just a picture and it went like nuts. It was going nuts with a whole lot of retweets. And it said, the only terrorists in America are white men with guns.
Mm-hmm.
And once I tweeted that, I got blocked off Twitter for 2 days.
It doesn't seem like that should be an incredibly controversial thing to say, considering how many of these sorts of attacks that we've had.
It's true. It's true. And it's crazy because I feel like we really have to change as people. The shooting in Texas, right? It just popped in my head. The shooting in Texas. Have you heard of the Central Park Five?
Yeah, of course.
Donald Trump put out an ad saying these kids, innocent kids, needed to be killed, death penalty. I'm pretty sure he didn't investigate. I'm pretty sure he didn't know what was going on. This guy goes in Walmart, kills innocent families.
Yeah.
Where's the ad saying he needs the death penalty?
He doesn't seem as fired up about it this time.
Where is his response to these guys that were locked up, that were innocent, who spent their whole life in jail? That he put an ad out saying they need to get killed. Where's the response?
Most recent that we've heard of him on that topic is that he still thinks that they should have been. That he doesn't buy that their record was cleaned.
The hate he gives makes people think it's okay to go shoot up places. It's crazy.
And incredibly disheartening on a daily basis.
Yes.
Now, to counteract some of that hate, you and I believe Greg as well, you're working to raise money for people in the area. So can you tell us about that?
Yes, we are raising money for my cousin and his kids. We're going to release a track. All the royalties and all the downloads and streams will be paid to my cousin's kids. And we're going to do this. And I hope everyone pays attention to this because this is big. It's big. I feel like instead of being like a race issue, I feel like we need to heal as people,
mm-hmm.
humanity. We need to heal. We need to save ourselves because this is like, it's crazy. It's nuts.
Yeah.
When is it going to be enough? When is enough? You know what I'm saying? It's really, really bad right now.
Yeah. As the years go by, different sorts of terror attacks happen. And you think, as horrible as each individual one is, maybe this will be the one that will get people to take it seriously.
Yes.
And instead, just more and more horrendous sorts of attacks get normalized, like the idea that you know, preschoolers are shot up. Like, people just get used to it. Churches, people get used to it.
It's like it's normal. It's something of the norm. And it's something that we have to change. And I feel like we all have to change as people.
Yeah.
It can't be a certain group of people or a certain color of people. I feel like change comes with everyone. And I feel like change should just... We need change, period. Like, that's just it.
Let me ask you, so after going through this experience, If there's a chance politicians might be watching this, we have some politicians who appear quite frequently. What would you like to be done? If someone who is responsible, who actually takes this seriously, could put pressure on the government to do something, is there anything in particular that you think might help to avoid other people having to go through what you and your family, including your cousin, have gone through?
The thing that could help is more like paying more attention to things, being more conscious of your surroundings, and just getting the story out there. Yeah. I want the story to get out there. I want everyone to know about this story. I don't want to quit talking about this story. I want this story to be huge. I want everyone to know my cousin's name. Yeah. Like, everyone needs to know his name, because it's not fair. No, everyone that died that night did not deserve to die like that. And it's just crazy. One of the girls' name's Lola Grisby. Mm-hmm. She died that night. She called her boyfriend on FaceTime. Like, I'm shot in the head. Take care of the kids.
Oh my God, I had not heard that.
Yeah, that's real life. She had a newborn baby she's never going to see take the first steps. This is crazy. And then you have the president of the United States at a press conference say, "I feel so sorry for the city of Toledo."
Yeah.
This was that's intentional, man. Like, he does that just to disrespect us.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was definitely on purpose, and he doesn't care. He probably doesn't even know what happened just by that comment.
I can't imagine how much, just insult to injury.
Yeah, like,
not even know the city.
To not know the city and come to the city, and just it's weird. It was a weird situation, and I feel like he's definitely to blame for a lot of these massive attacks and these shootings, and he's to blame.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to make sure that people understand that connection. We've been talking about it a lot.
And also, I do want to say to the youth my age, for us to really make change, we have to start voting. I know it's hard. I know sometimes, like, it just seems like it doesn't pertain to us because we're so young, but change comes with us. And I feel like we have to change that way. So please go vote. Everyone vote. Everyone, especially the youth.
Yeah,
that's like, I want to get that message out there. Like, we have to vote.
Thank you. Yeah, there's no excuse not being involved, considering the stakes.
For sure.
Jevin, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's got to be difficult, but want to make sure that this doesn't get normalized like we were talking about, and you're helping to make sure that it doesn't. So thank you.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to take one last break. We come back, a little bit more news for you, and close out the show. Almost the only thing that Bernie Sanders has ever wanted in his entire life is for people to take income inequality, the economic situation of working Americans, seriously, and for the media to actually cover it every once in a while. But they don't, because it's not exciting enough, it's not sexy enough. But thankfully, he does from time to time get the help of people who are natural drawers of attention to get people to focus on this issue. And coming up tomorrow, he's got a full interview with Cardi B about income inequality and related issues. We have a small excerpt that we want to show you now.
What are we going to do about wages?
Good.
In America?
Good. An excellent and important question. Because right now, we have tens of millions of people who are earning what I consider to be starvation wages. Can you imagine somebody today earning $9 an hour?
It don't make no sense.
No, it doesn't. How do you pay your rent? How do you pay for food? How do you pay for transportation?
Right.
You can't pay. And if you have a child.
Yes. And my thing is that, you know, certain people like to brag that there is more jobs now in America. But it's like, yeah, there's an increase of jobs given. But what are they paying?
Right.
And these jobs, they're practically paying nothing.
You got it. That is exactly the issue. So you can get a job, but maybe you're going to have to work for two or three jobs.
Exactly.
Legislation that I've introduced, which was passed in the House recently, U.S. House, would raise that minimum wage to $15 an hour. And what we also have to do is make it easier for workers to join unions so they can sit down and engage in collective bargaining and earn a decent living.
So in that, I think it was like a 50-second video, there was a more serious consideration of a number of related issues than you'll see probably all day on MSNBC, unfortunately. But look, he's with Cardi B. It looks like it's going to be awesome. We'll find out tomorrow. But I hope that this draws attention to some of these issues. Even though, let's acknowledge, it shouldn't be necessary. The numbers are so crazy when it comes to our economy that that should be all it takes to get people to talk about these issues. As an example, this is something that came out this week, and it has to do with the family that controls Walmart. In the hour that it takes a new Walmart employee to earn the $11 starting wage, the family that owns Walmart has banked $4 million. That is the sort of statistic. Yes, it involves a bunch of numbers and everything, but it's so crazy that, like, I think a regular person hears that and thinks, what is going on in our system? Let's break this down a little bit more. I think Robert Reich has been doing a good job on Twitter of spreading these numbers. It breaks out to the Walton fortune increasing by an eye-watering $70,000 per minute, every minute, all year long. That's $4 million per hour, or $100 million every single day. Every single day. $70,000 in a minute. Like this video, they will have earned enough to buy a Ferrari or a Lamborghini in the time it takes for me to babble through this story, basically. That's the situation that we're in as a country. Now, it's not just the Waltons, we focus on them because they're so fabulously wealthy as a group. But it's been a good couple of years for wealthy people all over the country and all over the world. For the 25 wealthiest families in the world, they collectively control almost $1.4 trillion. 25 families, $1.4 trillion. That's a 24% increase from last year. So they were, I'm going to say, apocalyptically wealthy last year, and they increased dramatically just in 365 days, thanks to laws in the US and around the globe that are written for their benefit. And so is it any wonder that no matter how we do, whether there's recession or not, whether wages go up or not, they always do better. Now let's talk about Bernie Sanders and his attempts to keep us focused on these issues, because that information about wealthy families and the Waltons in particular, that's been circulating this week, and good on any of the media outlets who actually talked about it. It's great to see the focus on how well these families are doing. But Bernie Sanders has been not just talking about these issues, he's even been talking about these families himself for some time. Earlier this year, February of 2019, he tweeted, "The Walton family makes more money in 1 minute than Walmart workers do in an entire year." This is what we mean when we talk about a rigged economy, something that he does talk about all the time. And that statement was considered so controversial that the Washington Post actually did a fact check of it, because they didn't believe that it could possibly be true. And so they dispatched Glenn Kessler, who looked into it, broke down all these different numbers based on a lot of different assumptions. And for once, they actually turned out agreeing with Bernie Sanders. They posted this, even assuming a 40-hour week, the average Walmart worker earns less in a year than the Walton family earns in a minute, just from dividends paid on the family's stock holdings. It's an astonishing statistic, and it happens to be correct. Sanders thus earns the coveted Geppetto checkmark, which I don't think I've ever heard of the Geppetto checkmark before. Regular readers know that we reserve this rating for claims that are unexpectedly true, and that's certainly the case here. Now, I sort of get why the Washington Post would be shocked that he'd be right about this sort of thing, because they seem to think that their mission is to fact check the hell out of Bernie Sanders. And oddly, we've talked about this before, even when in their articles they show stat by stat how Bernie Sanders is right, they always end up sort of massaging it down to partly true based on assumptions they make about what they think he meant, not the actual content of his messages. Here, the numbers are so stark that they can't even do that, and so they have to give him the Geppetto checkmark that I now love. It is unexpectedly true, it is shockingly true that some families do so well in comparison to the vast majority of working Americans. But what's not a shock, what's not unexpected, is that it's Bernie Sanders who was out in front making sure that people knew about this. Months before a big new report comes out that they can't argue with, they just have to accept that the numbers are true, he was trying to spread that message earlier this year, and of course it goes back even farther than that. That is the history of Bernie Sanders. He is the guy who is unexpectedly accurate on the most important issues facing the American people. It would be great every once in a while if people paid attention to him when he's actually saying it, and not just wait until the great weight, the inertia of American politics and political discourse finally catches up to him. Years after, when people like Donald Trump are in power, maybe once pay attention when he's pushing his message in the first place. And hopefully now is the time. Hopefully with the power of Bernie Sanders combined with Cardi B, people will pay attention. We'll find out tomorrow, of course. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. We don't have much time. I wanted to read an iTunes review. You guys have been posting some great reviews on iTunes. These written reviews are awesome. They give me strength and help me continue in this career field. So please keep doing that. I swear we're gonna read some later. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.